This is Jackie B. Peterson. I'm your host today on Solo Pro Radio. I am also the author of Better, Smarter, Richer, 7 Business Principles for Solo and Creative Entrepreneurs. And as you know, what we like to do on this show is talk to solopreneurs in all the different ways that they carry out their businesses. But Better, Smarter, Richer is a fill-in-the-blanks workbook, and it's designed to help solos take a look at their thinking and see if they can identify what it is that is keeping them from the financial success that they want and deserve. Better, Smarter, Richer is also a coaching system, which consists of the book, a facilitator's guide, my online course, plus some online classes, and the most popular one that you can find on my website is called How to Charge What You're Worth. So if you're a solo, go to the Better, Smarter, Richer website, www.bettersmarterricher.com. You can download my free ebook outlining the 7 business principles. You can sign up for our newsletter, which comes out and gives you ideas and tips on how to be successful as a solo. And also join the conversation on the blog. We've got quite a lively discussion that goes on there with many of my radio guests. It's really fun to continue talking with some of the people that you've enjoyed hearing so much on the show. So today, my guest is Barbara Hetwer. She's been a teacher, wife, and mother, and now she's a novelist writing a historical novel set in the California Gold Rush. Barbara has drawn on her own life experiences to flesh out her main character, Emma Randall, who decides to follow her dream and travel alone to the Wild West. She has also drawn on her own family history, as her mother was a New York City seamstress for Kate Smith and Eleanor Roosevelt. Originally from California, Barbara now lives in rural Oregon with space for her horse and time for writing. Hello, Barbara.
Hello, Jackie. It's great to be on your program today.
I'm glad you're here. I'm quite a reader, so I'm looking forward to learning more about your book and, of course, the writing process. So before we begin all of that, why don't you tell us about your journey? You know, like, where'd you grow up and go to school, and what kind of work have you done before deciding to become a writer and a novelist?
Well, what I did prior to becoming a novelist, I didn't think had anything to do with becoming a novelist. But now that I look back on it, I see it did, because I just learned from all the experiences in my life, which then play into the characters in my book. And I was born in Southern California in Los Angeles, and grew up in a town near there. And I went to Catholic schools for 12 years. Taught by nuns in the habits in those good old days. They had everything in their pockets, like scissors, tape, glue, and even one time when I fainted, I found out they had smelling salts in their pockets.
That's funny.
Yeah. And so when I went to college, and I didn't know what I wanted to do, except I thought I wanted to travel. So I decided to become a teacher, because that way I could have summers off and travel. And then I thought, well, if I decided to get married and have children, then I would have the same holidays off as my children, so that would be good for that also. So that's why I became a teacher, not exactly the purest motives in the world. I had never had much experience with children. As the youngest in my family, I hadn't babysat or anything like that. So I did become a teacher, and I taught junior high in Southern California. Then I did get married and have children, and I quit teaching and just worked a lot with my kids and did volunteer teaching, you know, helping at their school and things like that. Then I got a horse, and eventually I moved to Oregon, and my life was completely different than Southern California. I had to learn how to chop wood to heat my house with the wood stove. And I had to learn to break the ice on the top of the horse trough so the horse could get water in the winter time, because I was at about 1,600 feet elevation in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains. So it got pretty cold, which I had never experienced before.
Wow.
So it was a completely different life. But in a way, it taught me 2 entirely different worlds, which now I know I'm very comfortable in the city. When I take my husband down to Southern California, I'm much more comfortable driving on the freeways down there than he is, because that's where I learned to drive. It doesn't bother me at all that there's cars cutting in front of me and motorcycles. flying by at 100 miles an hour in between the two lanes. But it also, I'm perfectly comfortable in the country and shoveling manure and cleaning horses' hooves. So I think all of that has joined together to, you know, help me have a variety of background experiences. And in addition to that, when I came to Oregon, I started teaching again. I just slowly got back into it by becoming an aide at my son's school, and then eventually got back into teaching, and then eventually was working at a small private high school and became the principal. And I was the principal there for about 5 years.
Wow!
Then I just went back to teaching for a couple of years, and then I retired. So all of that has, and at that school, that was a totally different kind of curriculum, and that's in my book also. It's the kind of curriculum that they had, like that the founding fathers of our country would have had. Not, it's more of a classical curriculum, so it's not like what I had even growing up, where I had excellent grammar and literature classes, but it's more than that. It's, you learn more from the original documents. So I ended up having to teach classes, like, I was a math teacher, and I ended up having to teach Euclid's Elements by having the students read Euclid's Elements books 1 through 6, and that's how we studied geometry.
Oh, my goodness.
It was a completely different experience for me, but definitely, again, widened my view of life and my understanding of knowledge. Also, I taught Aristotle's Rhetoric. We read Aristotle's Rhetoric, and the students learned how to write better and think clearer based upon that. So that has all led to this point of now I'm retired, and, oh, when I write a book, all that weaves its way into the story.
That's quite an interesting story, Barbara. There's places where you and I link quite a bit. I was in Catholic schools with the sisters in full-blown habits for the first 8 years of my school life, and so I really understand about the big pockets and, you know, the discipline. And I tell people to this day that the nuns monitored our lunch hour, and so in the cafeteria, so you'd bring out your lunch and take a bite out of your sandwich, and then they counted how many times you chewed.
Seriously.
Seriously.
Well, ours monitored the trash cans and looked inside your little lunch sack to make sure you weren't throwing away any food, because that's
Think of the discipline we got from that.
Yes.
And, you know, I also did just about kind of the same thing. We bought rural property and got horses. And so when my kids were growing up, we were out on acreage, 11 acres, and everybody in the family had a horse. And I was just telling somebody last week that I have this picture of my son, who's just about to turn 40, when he was 2, underneath the belly of a horse. He'd kind of toddled over there, and he was underneath the belly of the horse.
And you took a picture? You didn't take a
No, I didn't take a picture. I was so horrified, I ran over and got him out, but I thought, oh, my God, you know? That's my mental picture.
Right.
So I really understand, you know, that you teach yourself all these new things by leaving, you know, the rural or the urban life behind to head out to the rural, and it is very different. I used to tell people that I came to work in the morning, and I, you know, people would say, oh, you look so nice, but what's that in your hair? And it would be a strand of, you know, hay, because I'd been out feeding the horses in my, you know, my big gum boots before I came to work.
I had exactly the same experience. I would go to work teaching, and about second or third period, one of the girls would just walk up to me and start pull something out of my hair, and it was hay.
I understand that. So this is just great experience, and I can see how you would integrate it all into your book. But have you always been a writer? I mean, this whole time as a teacher and principal and parent?
No, not at all. I was
really
a math teacher, and I am very analytical, and 2 + 2 = 4 always, and don't ever try to argue that with me. And I just didn't even like, I liked reading Nancy Drew books when I was a kid, but you know, I wasn't a great literary person much beyond that. When I got older, I read things like Louis L'Amour books.
Right,
or Western books. But I read other things too, but I would not consider myself an avid reader, and I had never written anything. And my mother, when I was in school, would tell me, write, they say you should write about what you know about. And I'd go, but Mom, I haven't ever been out of California. I don't know about anything. And so I always had trouble in school. I could never write anything well and get a good grade on it. What I discovered was that what I have always been is a storyteller.
Ah.
And so I still consider myself now a storyteller and not a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did, and I realized that a couple of years ago when I thought I was boring one of my sons with rambling on and on, some experience I had had, and I said, I'm really sorry I'm boring all of you. And he said, no, Mom, I love your stories. So that's kind of when I thought, oh, maybe I can tell a story. So I have never written anything before this.
Wow. So other than retiring, kind of what inspired you to recognize your storytelling skills and write a novel? What how'd that happen?
Well, probably as is with many women of my age, I don't always sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was lying there awake in bed one night and I thought, oh, I think this is going to be one of those nights when I never get to sleep. But I discipline myself and I won't let myself use any electronic devices because I want my brain to get some rest. So no, I don't get up and get on the computer or watch TV or anything. I just lie there and, you know, after I pray for everyone I know and I'm still awake, I'm like, oh, no. Like, what am I going to do? So I thought, I'm going to entertain myself by making up a story. And what's the kind of movie I like to see or the kind of book I like to read? And it's historical fiction. So I thought, now, if I was going to make up a story, what would it be like? And, well, my mother always said you have to write about what you know about. So my character would have to be a Catholic. I just can't get out of that one. And she'd have to go to Catholic schools and be taught by nuns. Okay. And if it was a long time ago, she would have lived in Baltimore. So that's how that all started. And then she'd have to have that same adventurous spirit that I have where I came to the rural countryside of Oregon, and she would, in those days, have headed out west. So that's how the story started, and I made up this nice little story in my head, and I entertained myself all night long with that nice little story. And I woke up in the morning, and I didn't wake up. I got up in the morning, and I told my husband, I made up a story last night, and I think I'm going to write it down. And he said, that's really good. You go ahead and do that. So I did. It took a month. I was amazed because I had to fill in all the description, all the conversation. And so at the end of a month, I let my husband read it, and he said, this is really good. Are you going to publish this? And I thought it was a book that would appeal to women more than to men. So I was kind of surprised. And all he ever reads is the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
So then I let my son read it, and my son said, yeah, Mom, this is good. I'm like, okay. So I had, anyway, that's just how it happened. And then
wow.
I started expanding on the story. I added a part two and had several friends edit it and got a publisher.
Wow. Wow. So let's talk about that in a minute. So your experience was that you started out entertaining yourself, so you didn't start out with the idea of I'm going to write a book that's going to be published. You started with the idea of telling yourself a story to entertain yourself and drew upon all these experiences and developed a character out of that, and you're carrying it around in your head, which probably really kept you awake.
Yes. Defeated the whole
purpose. Until you finally decided to write it down. Were you ever in the concept of gosh, I've shifted from telling a story to entertain myself to I'm going to write a story that I can publish and I can make a book out of that I'm going to try to sell. I mean, did you experience that kind of a shift where it...
Yes, I don't know when that happened.
Uh-huh.
It was probably after my husband read it. Prior to that, I had thought, I think this is a nice little story, and I think when I'm dead and gone, my grandchildren will read this and be really impressed that I wrote this. And then once I started having friends and relatives read it and telling me that it was good and that I should publish it, and then I started getting serious about, yeah, I guess I should do that.
Very good. So did you ever get a coach or take any writing classes that said things like there has to be a beginning, a middle, and the end? There has to be some sort of a crisis and then it gets solved, and, you know, a moment of catharsis and it moves on? Or, you know, any of these theories of writing a novel?
Everything you just mentioned, the nuns taught me.
Ah.
No, I never got a writing coach. And once I decided to really try to make this into a full-length novel, because when I started, it was like probably one-third the length it ended up being in the end. So I decided to expand it, and I knew I wanted to get it published. And I have some friends who are real writers. And
Barbara, you're a real writer.
I don't know. I'm accepting the fact that I'm a storyteller who has learned how to write.
Okay, I like that.
Yes. My friends are more people who have been writing all their lives and love writing, and have had maybe some small little things published, like in a magazine article or something. But they work for years and years and years, and they go to writers' groups. And they go to writers' groups and they get told, no, that character isn't strong enough, or no, this isn't the kind of book people are buying right now, or whatever. And then they keep throwing it away and starting over again. And they have written some really good things that I have read. I said, I would love for you to finish this book and read this. And they never do it because they're always getting too much input. So I decided I was not going to get too much input. So I wrote my whole story before I submitted it to a real editor for editing. And then I said, oh, really? You want more conversation between Emma and her mother? You'd want me to show more than tell? Okay, I can add more conversation. And then I started making those kinds of changes.
So the editor, was the editor like an agent editor or a publisher editor?
Publisher editor.
Oh, wow.
I was a publisher, and I got it. I'm basically self-published. I chose a publisher, and then I bought one of their publishing packages, which included editing.
Okay. You know, that's so interesting to me, all the things that have happened in publishing. You know, there used to be all the old rules, and now there's hundreds of different ways for people to get self-published. So it's where people are going. You know, the traditional publishing business almost doesn't exist anymore unless you're Barack Obama and you have this fabulous platform and they beg you to write a book and give you $1 million advance, you know, that sort
right.
of thing. And then provide a ghostwriter to help you, you know. But that almost doesn't exist anymore. So what you're talking about with self-publishing is pretty fantastic. So you chose a publisher who had instructions and kind of some, they said, okay, this is worth pursuing, and they helped you, they coached you with what would make it more readable. Is that right?
That is correct. I probably went through about 4 different editing processes with them.
Uh-huh.
The first one, a person just read it and gave me comments on each chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, add more conversation between Emma and her mother, or I don't like that you've titled this chapter something that gives away what before the person gets there. Things, you know, really helpful things.
Yeah.
So
it sounds like it.
Mm-hmm. And that was the first step. And then later on, they started getting, you know, more and more picky. And then there was a copy editor that just, you know, told me that the way that Voyages in English taught me to do my commas and semicolons was wrong. And I said, fine, do whatever you want. Basically, semicolons have gone out of fashion.
Yes.
They're just using a lot more commas.
Yes. And I like semicolons. I understand that. That's one of the problems I had with my
book.
Maybe
that should be my next book, like A Love Affair with Semicolons or something.
I was helping a group by facilitating a mission writing experience yesterday, and one of the members is clearly an English major because we were having a discussion on whether to put in what he called the Oxford comma, which was the comma after we had a, you know, two alternatives and then before the word and, whether we were going to put a comma before the word and or whether and superseded the comma. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh.
Well, yes, and I did not put those commas in, and my publisher put them in, and I am now on about 6 different writers' groups online, but I didn't do that until after I wrote my book on purpose, because I didn't want my basic storyline to become somebody else's storyline.
I can understand that. I can understand that, you know, and you don't want to get your ideas muddied with somebody else's input.
Right.
Yeah.
So once I got my what was in my heart down on paper, then I started getting into these circles and listening to all these people. And that comma before the and is now the way things are going.
Oh, I'm glad to know that.
Yeah.
It was interesting. We were in the middle of this a manufacturing plant, you know, having this discussion about, as he called it, the Oxford comma. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. We're standing next to the CNC machine discussing the Oxford comma. It's interesting. Anyway, talk to us about your story. You know, how did you imagine Emma, and is she made up for, you know, your own life experiences? And, I mean, how did you do this? Tell us about Emma.
Emma is a much more mature, thoughtful person than I ever was at a young age. Because I grew up in Southern California, and to me, all that mattered was that I could iron my blonde hair on the ironing board and get it straight so I looked like a surfer girl. So I was rather superficial when I was young, even though I always was really thinking a lot. So Emma is more that kind of pondering, thinking, truly trying to understand life. She's a serious person.
Uh-huh.
And all along.
It could be your alter ego.
Yeah, maybe. It's just that's her nature. And her mother, to her, seems very, very flighty. And kind of, my mother wasn't like that, but my mother was sick a lot. So I have her mother being sick, and she doesn't get her mother, and her mother's always thinking, say, oh, I think I shall faint, and she falls back onto the sofa. And so Emma just looks at that and is like, this is what I don't want to be. She tries to never be judgmental, and mm-hmm. she's respectful to her mother, but she doesn't understand her, and she doesn't want to be like her. So her father is this intellectual who does all this classical education with her and hires tutors and gets her very well educated. And then she becomes a teacher. Well, duh, that's like me. So, but what her mother teaches her is embroidering and sewing. And there's very few things that she learns in her life that are practical because her parents are wealthy and they have servants. And she's being raised to be a society lady. And she goes to all the proper social events and dresses properly and is not even allowed to yawn in public. And my mother was from New York, and she did not permit me to yawn in public,
mm-hmm.
not even if I covered my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So she's taught all this propriety, and she thinks it's all so superficial. And that's this desire in her to go west starts when she's really about 12 years old, and she educates herself and reads and reads and reads. So eventually, when she's 21, she heads out west, and that's where the fun begins.
Oh, wow. How interesting to put all that story together while you're lying in bed.
Oh, dear.
Yes. That was it. My imagination just firing. I love that, and I can see that. I was just thinking as you were talking about Emma not appreciating your mother, how many of our parents have given us impetus in our life because we're looking at our parents and thinking, I don't want to be like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our parents, us included as parents, are working so hard to be a good role model, and our kids are watching us, and they're thinking, I don't ever want to be like that.
Right, right.
So,
there's a theme in my book that does run through, which is that Emma finds that she misjudges people a lot without intending to. She finds out later, she comes to a deep understanding and close relationship with her mother later in life.
Oh,
and
good.
To really understand her and to see that what she saw in her mother was not the depth of who her mother was, but only her mother had a lot of hurt and pain, and that she was covering it all up. And there's a lot of times like that where there's someone in her life that she completely misjudges, not because she's trying to be mean or judgmental, but because she just doesn't have all the facts, and she's sure she's right. And then she has to say, admit to herself, I was wrong again.
So does she change her behavior? Does she become more open-minded before making a judgment, knowing that she has a tendency to misjudge people, so she stays out of judgment and just more into observation for a longer period until she gets to know the person better?
Yes.
Does she change her character?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
I mean, I think that shows. It's not stated, but yes, I think that's shown in...
That's a big message.
Yes.
You know, because I think a lot of people do that, you know. I used to do a whole lot of consulting around the concept of mental models. And mental models tells us that what we do is we learn to shortcut our opinions about others based on our own lifetime experience attached to the emotion that we felt with the experience and, you know, the experience itself. And therefore, what we do in order to shortcut our process, we begin to make quick judgments based on past experience. And, you know, that isn't necessarily true. And it does make people quite judgmental unless they can keep their minds open until they, you know, learn more. Instead of leaping to judgment. And, it's really quite a maturation to reach that point. So that's an interesting message to be having in your book. Good
yes.
work. Yeah, make it interesting.
Well, yes, I think the characters have to mature and change or it's boring and they're flat.
Yeah.
And then also, one thing that you mentioned in writing coach is having some sort of climax in the story or some sort of problem. And I realized that I needed that what the story I made up at night was all happy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized, no, this isn't, that's a boring story. So I put into it some, after her successful business, that she loses her business. So this has to do with being an entrepreneur also. She is a solopreneur.
Mm-hmm.
And she creates a business and is very successful and then has something really bad happen and
uh-huh.
lose the business. Then she has to start all over again. And she goes through depression and then has to, you know,
okay.
slowly come out of that and start over again in a whole new field.
But, you know, that speaks a lot to solos also. You know, you recounted your own journey from teaching to picking horses' feet, you know, in
right.
rural Oregon, you know, and that happens a lot with solos, that they start out in one direction and move to another, and while they're looking ahead, they often can't see the direction they're going. They just know and instinctively, you know, move from one thing to another, and when they finally land on something that's going to become a successful solo activity, or a successful solo business for them, they look back and they can see, you know, what they've learned and grown out of every one of these experiences and how they have uniquely tied it together. So you're giving her, you know, exactly what happens with a solo. They, you know, experience changes and have to adapt. And, you know, usually it's three or four activities into something before one of them finally works. That's not unusual at all. In fact, I have to tell you, one of the definitions of an entrepreneur is that they keep trying things until one of them works.
Right.
So, with Emma, did you do a lot of research? You know, she's a seamstress, and research about women heading west and about the time of the gold rush. Did you have to do that for writing your book?
I'm embarrassed to say that no, I didn't. I did as I went along. I did not... prior to writing the book.
Okay.
And I did not do a lot of research about a seamstress because simultaneously my mother had recorded the memories of her life and had also written the story of her life twice, and she was a seamstress. So it was very easy for me to have all of that in there. I didn't have to do the research. I already knew that. And, like, what I have Emma doing a lot is embroidering and my mother went to the New York public schools, graduated from high school, and then was recommended, because she had to take sewing, was recommended for this some kind of special, like, it was more than a sewing school. It was where you could become a dress designer or different fields like that. And she went there for 1 year, and then she got a job at Milgram's, which was one of the top dress designing houses in New York at the time. This was like in 1938. And that's where she embroidered the initials on Kate Smith's lingerie.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. I mean, I was like, what? You mean people had their initials embroidered?
Wow.
When you took it to Goodwill, then nobody wanted it, right? I don't know. And she described how the dresses were made. So and then my mother taught me to sew. So I didn't have to do research on any of that. But coming out west, I did do research on, but a lot of that we already know, you know, about the railroad going through. And so I have Emma, being the thoughtful, intelligent person that she is, she waits till the railroad goes through to the west, till the Golden Spike is in, and she can take the train all the way.
Oh, very good.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then part of the train does stop in Truckee, and so part of the story of the Donner Party plays into it. And then there's a person from the Donner Party who, in doing my research on the town of Jamestown, California, which is the gold mining town where she ends up living, one of the Donner Party survivors lived there and was a woman and married a very wealthy man. And so that weaves a little bit into the story. There's also, when I went to Jamestown, there's this really nice old hotel there that was there back, it's there now, it's a bed and breakfast, and it was there back in the day when my character was there, which was 1870. And there was a mysterious event that happened there, and it involved a seamstress. So I had Emma be the seamstress, so I wove true history in to that event.
Oh,
a really interesting part of the story.
That's good.
Yes,
that's
and
good.
Then I did have to do research on gold mining because I really didn't know much about that. But I, as I was doing it, I was thinking how easy it is nowadays to write a book, because all you have to do is Google something, and there it is. I have 1,285,000 websites that can tell me about this.
Isn't that the truth?
Yes.
It really is the truth.
It gave me great admiration for people who wrote books 100 years ago or even 50 years ago.
Yes. Yes, doesn't it? I mean, it's quite amazing, whereas now we've got everything at our fingertips, in fact, too much.
Yes.
So at some point then with your publisher, did they give you any advice, or you were self-publishing? You decided you were done, right?
Yes.
And so then you move into the big process of printing the book and marketing the book. How has that process worked for you?
Well, that is one area where I am definitely expanding my life, because I have never sold anything, and I've always been the kind of person that says I couldn't sell a drink of water to a man dying of thirst in the desert. I have never wanted to do anything. Like when I agreed to become the principal of the high school, I said to this man who agreed to be the administrator, I will do this if I don't have to do anything that deals with a dollar sign. And he said, that's fine, I'll take care of all that. And I said, okay. So now here I am having to self-promote my book, and I am not a natural self-promoter, and having to deal with all the finances of it. So this is quite a new experience for me, but I'm finding it actually fun and easy, which is surprising. But my publisher is very good. They, I have gotten from them lots of flyers and postcards to send out to bookstores, and I have contacted the local newspaper, and they're going to have an article. They have a local literature section, and they feature one book, so they're going to feature my book 1 week. and there's a little local free newspaper that comes out, and they're going to have an article about me in there. And I'm going to be at the Oregon State Fair. They have an Oregon authors table. So they have about 50 authors there. So I will be there. And so I'm planning on spending the next year on trying to sell and promote my book. And it's actually forced me to get into social media, which I always said I would never do. But now I'm a Facebooker. And a few other things, too. So it's going well, but it's not my area of expertise, and I'm learning a lot quickly.
I can see that Emma's Adventure kind of parallels your own, that in order to publish Emma's Adventure, you're having to go on your own adventure of learning, you know, how to research, how to write, how to edit, how to publish, how to sell, how to do social media, you know, how to manage customers, how to price things, you know, how to count your sales. I mean, wow. So you may not be panning for gold, but in a sense, you really are panning for gold, but you're doing it in today's vernacular of, you know, going after the gold by going after you know, appearances and sales and, you know, social media and Facebook and things like that. You know, that's how we're panning for gold today.
Yes.
And we're doing it there. Good for you. I think you have as big a sense of adventure as Emma does.
Well, that's what my mother said when I moved to Oregon. She thought I was too adventurous. I do. You're moving.
We're pretty wild here in Oregon.
Oh,
that's pretty wild.
It is.
And you bought a horse.
Yes. Pretty wild, too. And I would ride my horse in the woods by myself.
But I always had a dog.
Good for you.
No. Oh, I think that's wonderful. Horses are fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
So are you, you know, have you been kind of welcomed by other fiction writers? Are they, you know, opening the circle and, you know, welcoming you in and, you know, are you kind of getting known as an Oregon novelist? Is that beginning to happen for you?
Well, I think I'm so early in the process, I don't really know. But what I'm finding is the people that I have talked to are very helpful. And I'm amazed at just the people I meet, like at my husband's school reunion, that it's like, oh, well, I've written a book, or I love reading books. Give me your business card. I'll help you. And I've had more people offer to help me at the state fair. They said, well, you can't be there from open till close every day. I'll sit there and sell your book for part of the time. I mean, people are just extremely supportive, even some people that I don't even know very well.
Uh-huh.
And then as far as other authors, they're always encouraging. And the writers groups that I'm now in online are very helpful, and I've actually met a couple of people there who have given me some very good tips on pricing. One of them gave really good tips on pricing. Another one gave really good tips on the Oxford comma. No, I'm just kidding. Gave good tips, you know, just on many different things, and I've connected up with one other fiction writer who I like her book, and I bought her book and read it, and I'm kind of trying to promote it on my site. And a lot of those other fiction writers are now promoting my book on their sites.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think that concept of cross-promotion is really, really helpful,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's hard as a solo to make an impression. You know, you're just one person out of 7 billion on the planet. Mm-hmm. But if a group of you get together and you cross-promote and you even maybe had a combined website where all of you who had historic novels, you know, were talking together and, you know, giving people, you know, things like that.
Yes.
Or if you did speaking engagements together and talked about lessons learned from writing the story of Emma Randall, you know, I think there's all kinds of ways that you could promote that way, and that probably the group together of you could promote that way. So maybe that might be your next step.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. You know, all of us who are solos talk about the joy of it is being independent and free to make your own schedule and do what you want when you want. I mean, that's truly wonderful. The downside of it is how to get heard and market your product, because it's hard to just be one little voice. And so then you say, okay, how can we be more than one voice? And, you know, certainly all the tools of the internet that you're talking about are part of that, but also people joining together, you know, to look bigger, kind of like a school of fish, you know.
Yes.
One little minnow swimming alone, you know, it's pretty not noticeable, but if you got a bunch of you coming together, then you're worth taking notice.
Yes, and I think I'm looking forward to that at the Oregon State Fair and meeting the other Oregon authors, and I think I will pick up some good connections there with the other authors that might work towards what you're talking about.
Yeah,
that has happened online. You know, some people have blogs, and they have let me guest blog
mm-hmm.
on their blog.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
very helpful.
And I would think that would be, because if you do a blog, do you have your own blog yet?
Yes, I do.
And how do you, you know, what is your point of view? Are you talking about it as a writer or as a writer of historical fiction?
You know, I'm so new at this. I've only posted about one blog a month, and it's
mm-hmm.
really just about my book.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it's about I'm going to be at the state fair, but then another one was all about my mother, and about
mm-hmm.
my mother being a seamstress, and has a picture of my mother and her sister and a cousin in these beautiful dresses because they were all going to go out dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Just things like that that somehow do relate to my book.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, what happens is that you want to adopt a point of view, okay, that you kind of get known for something. So you've made your first foray out there, and you're known for, I can think of a lot of things, for trying new things, for deciding to take an adventure in your life after you've retired. There are a lot of people, by the way, who are interested in that topic. You know, writing. There are a lot of people who are just interested in writing. Historical fiction. There are a lot of people who are interested in historical fiction. You know, but you kind of want to get known for something, you know, that you lead with. And you may want to think about that, and then focus your blog and your talks to people and your approaches kind of around whatever that centrist thing is. It helps people identify you more. And it's great to have it be about, you know, the your book, Seamstress Experience with the Seamstress of Jamestown. But, you know, what you may want to write another book. And so it would be the books of Barbara Hetwer, and maybe you have a theme for those books, and that's where you have to, you know, what do you do next is always the issue. And, I mean, are you pining to write another book at this point? Are you thinking, gee, I'd like to write another one?
Yes, I have several books floating around in my brain. actually, my next book, which I've already started, isn't really writing a book. It's compiling the memoirs of my mother's life.
Okay.
She wrote the story twice, and then she recorded it once. So I have typed all that up, but it's in very rough form. I have to just move little sections around to get it all chronological.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the story, she says, well, I hope this story is put together with the pictures, otherwise it could be boring. So I have all the old family photo albums, and I need to spend a month going through them to find the pictures that match up with the story. And then I'm just going to do one of those picture books
mm-hmm.
that you just make yourself online. And
uh-huh.
I am not planning on editing. I really got into doing research by getting into researching family genealogy. That's how I started researching, and that increased my interest in historical things and gave me a background for writing some historical fiction, because I knew about some of my relatives that lived in that time period. So for my mother's book, it's just going to be a picture book that I'll make online and that relatives can buy if they want to buy it.
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
And my genealogy friends have told me not to edit it. That, you know, if she says, well, Now, let me see. We went to Uncle Joe's house to just leave it just like that, you know, and not edit it. So that's not really writing a book, but it's compiling a book. And then the other book that I really, I could write a book about a couple of sequels to my book because I know what happens to a couple of them as children. And so I could expand upon that. But I really want to write a book about my grandmother's life. And I already have, like, the introduction page written.
Wow.
But I would need, because it's just fascinating. What I found when I researched my family was that if I wrote the story of their life as fiction, people would throw the book down and say, this is ridiculous, this never could have happened. And I even have a scene like that in my book, in The Seamstress of Jamestown, where I did research on what happened in Baltimore during the Civil War, and there was an incident where rail cars were moved, and the editor said, this never could have happened. And I gave him the link to the historical website that showed that it did happen. So I would love to write this story about my grandmother's life.
Oh, I think that would be great. You know, so if you write your mother's memoir and then you write the story of your grandmother, you really are, you know, moving into a path of, what would I call it, historical writing and maybe beyond a memoir. I mean, I'm sure you would have to use your grandmother's lifetime as an outline, and then what would you do, make up the dialogue and things like that.
Yes, and that's what I'm really struggling with, and trying to get on, get some advice from people on how you do that. But you just have to, make things up, and I dislike making up things about people's lives. But you have to make some assumptions. If they moved from here to there, you have to assume that they had a conversation about, let's move to this town.
Yes,
right.
You do. Yeah. Well, I can see that you're on quite a journey, and that you've had some fun and some success with this whole thing, and that we're going to hear more from you is what I'm getting. And I think this is just wonderful. And I think it's also wonderful that you're learning so much and have leaped into the, you know, just leaped into the lake of learning and said, I want my own adventure here, and my own adventure is going to show up this way, and it's going to lead me down many paths. So I want to really celebrate you for that and, you know, say good job. So we're almost out of time. It's been absolutely great talking with you. And so how can our listeners get hold of your book, The Seamstress of Jamestown?
Well, they can go to my blog, which can be reached by just going to BarbaraHetwer.com, which is BarbaraHetwer.com, and that leads to my blog. But also they can get it through Amazon and through some other places maybe. And then also it's only in paperback right now. The ebook will be out in about a month, and it'll be available on the Nook and Kindle. And they can also buy it directly from the publisher, which is Wine Press, and they would go to winepressbooks.com.
Wonderful. Well, as I say, I want to celebrate your adventure, and I want to tell you I greatly appreciate your taking time to be with us today. This has been a fun conversation. I've enjoyed it a lot, and I wish you much future success, so stay in touch with us. And listeners, remind you again, this is Jackie B. Peterson, author of Better, Smarter, Richer, 7 Business Principles for Solo and Creative Entrepreneurs. We've been having a discussion today with Barbara Hetwer. And I am going to be on vacation for a couple weeks. We're going to replay some shows for you. And I'm much needed rest, much needed getting away. I'm going to take an electronic free vacation. I'm going to be up in the mountains and away from the cell and away from the iPhone. But in the meantime, I hope you will go to my website, www.bettersmarterricher.com, and download the free ebook outlining the 7 business principles. Also sign up for the newsletter and the join the conversation in the blog. And if you're interested in doing the workbook Better, Smarter, Richer together with another cohort, I have an online program that is available. And I've got several online classes now, and as I said, I think the most popular one is called How to Charge What You're Worth. So in the meantime, enjoy the end of summer, and we will be talking to you soon. Goodbye.